Good morning. How's everyone doing this morning? Hello, Northfield Saga. My subject today is the first noble truth. And the Four Noble Truths is, you could say, is the foundation of Buddhism. It was the subject of the first Dharma talk given by the Buddha after his enlightenment. After his enlightenment, he went looking for his five companions that he had practiced with during the years leading up to his enlightenment, and he found them, and he gave them this talk about the Four Noble Truths. We have an introduction on Sunday mornings. It's going on upstairs right now, and one of the subjects of those talks, there are four that rotate, is the Four Noble Truths. But this morning, for people who have been to that introduction, this is a chance to hear about one aspect of the Four Noble Truths in a little more depth. And for folks who are very familiar with the Four Noble Truths, I hope I can offer a little bit of a different perspective this morning. And if you know nothing about the Four Noble Truths, I won't hold you in suspense. I'll tell you what they are. The first noble truth is that there is suffering in the world. The second is that suffering is caused by desire. The third is that we can end suffering by ending desire. And the fourth is that there is an eightfold path for doing this. That's a scheme that the Buddha came up with. Eight things we can work on in many areas of our lives to realize this truth. And those things are view, intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. So I approach this talk with some trepidation because the first noble truth is the truth of suffering. So that means it's my job this morning to talk to you for a while about suffering. It's kind of a tough subject, right? And I imagined everyone just being really saddened by this talk and leaving and thinking, you know, I could have gone on a walk in the woods this morning. It's a beautiful day. And I went to Zen Center and I heard this guy talk about suffering. So I'm going to begin with the top five reasons why it's not a total drag to hear about suffering, okay? The first one is, it's not really suffering. It's dukkha. It's dukkha. That's a Sanskrit word. Sanskrit, a language of ancient India. Dukkha is spelled D-U-H-K-H-A. Easy to misspell. And it's translated most often as suffering. Most people tell us that dukkha means suffering. But it's really a lot more than that. It's really a lot more nuanced than that. And I looked at a couple of Buddhist dictionaries for their definition of dukkha. That's often where I start my research. I looked at the Shambhala dictionary, and it says, dukkha not only signifies suffering in the sense of unpleasant situations, it also refers to everything, both material and mental, that is conditioned, that is subject to arising and passing away, that is comprised of the five skandhas, and that is not in a state of liberation. And the Oxford Dictionary of Buddhism says, there is no word in English covering the same ground as dukkha as it is used in Buddhism. The usual translation of suffering is too strong and gives the false impression that life according to Buddhism is nothing but pain. It goes on to say that dukkha does include the ordinary kinds of suffering, so physical or emotional pain, but it also includes deeper concepts such as impermanence and unsatisfactoriness. Impermanence is the idea that everything changes. We talk about impermanence a lot in Buddhism. We have a hard time accepting impermanence on a deep level. For instance, we have a hard time accepting aging. When things are going really well, we want them to go well permanently. We have a real hard time accepting that things might fall apart again. Unsatisfactoriness, I like to think of... Hi, come on in. I like to think of unsatisfactoriness as including the deep questioning that most of us have. Why are we here? What are we supposed to do? What is this life all about? what's the story with life and death? And I think it's painful for us not to have an answer to these questions. We want answers, and it seems like no one ever comes up with one. They think they do, but we still have that deep questioning. That's what first brought me to Buddhism, was that deep questioning. It first brought me, I would say, to spiritual inquiry, not to Buddhism. When I was about 15 or so, I started thinking about these life and death questions. And it was the other kind of suffering, the ordinary kind, that brought me to get serious about Buddhist practice, because I was a bit desperate. But that's another story. It's a story I haven't told yet, but I will at some point. So, the Oxford Dictionary says, dukkha is probably best left untranslated. So that's one reason why talking about suffering is not so terrible, why talking about dukkha is not so terrible. It's not just about suffering, it's about something deep about the human condition that is really worth looking into and that we need to look into if we're going to really, I'm not going to say understand this life, but find a way of being in this world. The second reason is, I think that if you're not willing to experience the suffering in life, you will not be able to feel the joy of life fully. And you won't be able to see how, ultimately, they're the same. That there's no real distinction between the two. And I'll talk more about that later. And I can think of a good example of that quality of being able to feel both joy and pain strongly, and to sort of let them both go and be in the moment. And that's when I've observed the Dalai Lama. I'm sure some of you have seen the Dalai Lama. He's been here a few times. I saw him in here and also in Madison. I was very fortunate to be able to do that. And I would just watch him kind of during breaks and things, because he would stay in the room. And he seems to have this wonderful capacity to be fully in the moment. And if he's talking to someone who's expressing sadness, you can see he's fully empathetic and he's fully there with the sadness. And yet, a minute later, something else happens and he lights up with joy. And it's not that he's superficial. It's just that he feels these things really strongly and he lets them go again. You know, he's let them both into his life. And I've tried to learn from this. I look at him as kind of a role model. As a clergy person, I often need to be present with the pain that other people are feeling, and I can't let it overwhelm me. I've got to take it in, I've got to let myself feel it, and I've got to let it go again. Same way with the joy. Sometimes it's not so easy. Sometimes it takes a lot of sitting before you can let go of things. And I always think of Thich Nhat Hanh writing about during the war in Vietnam when he said he was really in the thick of all of this, trying to end suffering in Vietnam. And he said, some days I had to do walking meditation for hours before I could settle myself down enough to go ahead and do what I have to do. The third reason why it's good to look at dukkha, it's okay to look at dukkha, is if you don't look at the pain voluntarily, it'll probably sneak up on you. It'll probably sneak up on you at an inopportune time when you really don't want to deal with it. Maybe it's a good idea to kind of let it come up a little bit when you're in a safe, controlled environment, such as Zen Center, when you're sitting on your cushion looking at the wall. Let it in a little bit. Let it in. It's going to come in. It's going to come in. The fourth is that facing suffering, or we might say touching suffering, which is a phrase Thich Nhat Hanh uses, helps us to open our heart, and that helps us to help others. This inquiry into human kindness is wrapped, or this inquiry into human dissatisfaction is wrapped in kindness. It has to be wrapped in kindness. And fifth, and this is the most important one, the truth of dukkha is only the first of the four noble truths. I think we could say that each of the four noble truths contains the other three, and no one of them can be thought of in isolation. Each one of them is the whole deal. So this talk about the first truth is really a talk about all four truths. And that's important, since the complete message is that suffering can be transcended, we might say. We can be free from suffering, we might say, at least to some extent. Or to put it in maybe a more sophisticated way, we can move beyond the distinction between suffering and joy. And Buddhism is not pessimistic. When we say that there is suffering in life, sometimes this unfortunately is translated as life is suffering. And that sounds like life is only suffering. That's not true. This is the path of joy. This is the path of joy. So here's the shortened version of the Four Noble Truths. The first is that suffering exists. Sickness, old age, and death exist. This basic questioning we have about who we are, this uneasiness with impermanence, no self. Our self knows deep down that it is an illusion, and that makes it scared. And it is relentless in asserting itself and trying to keep itself alive. And if you've done a few long retreats, you've probably experienced that. That can be one tiresome self that keeps coming back. The second is that suffering is caused by desire. And that's really the radical thing. You know, not all suffering is caused by desire. Physical pain is not caused by our desire. Sickness is not caused by our desire. But we can make these things so much more difficult through our desire, for things to be different. Buddhism can't help with the pain, the physical pain, but it can help with our attitude toward the pain. And so much of our suffering is caused by our desire for things to be different. It's not impermanence that makes us unhappy. It's our attitude toward impermanence. It's our unwillingness to accept it that makes us unhappy. And the third is that we can end our suffering by ending our desire. Say everything's going great one day. I have good energy and focus. I'm able to put in a long day. I have a really productive day. I'm at ease with people. I make people feel better. It's just a perfect day. But then I get a little fatigued, maybe the next day, and I feel that start to slip away a little bit. And I don't want it to slip away. So I start clinging to it. I can't accept the impermanence of this pleasurable state. So I'm thinking about how things should be, and then I end up fighting things as they are. I'm in denial. No, I don't want this to slip away. Things are still good. I'm going to keep doing what I did yesterday so that things continue to be good. And soon the whole thing falls apart, and I'm miserable. But what if I had ended my desire instead? What if I had been able to say, oh, wow, it slipped a little bit. Something is gone. I didn't feel so great in that moment. Well, that's interesting. Let's investigate that and see what happens. And if I can do that, I can still be present with the ever-changing conditions, whatever they are. There's not going to be a separation between what is and what I want. And that's the end of suffering. That's totally entering into what's going on right now and letting it be. And the fourth of the Four Noble Truths is the Eightfold Path, which is about bringing the practice to all phases of your life. And this path was developed 2,500 years ago, and it still works wonderfully well. We can still apply it to our modern life. And I'm not going to go through those, but there's just one I'd like to emphasize, which is right action. And the reason I'd like to bring that up is because there's often a misunderstanding when I talk about the Four Noble Truths. When I talk about accepting things as they are, letting things be as they are, simply letting them be, that can be mistaken for the idea that we should be passive and we should not try to change things. And if we can just accept anything that happens to us, we'll be fine. And that's not true at all. You don't accept injustice. You don't accept things being... you don't accept a world of suffering if you can do something about that suffering. When I talk about letting things be as they are, that's talking about seeing. That's talking about seeing the world as it is, not clouded by our desire. And once we see the world as it is, and we truly know it, then the question is, what do we do about it? And we act. We always act. That's what Buddhists do. We act to make the world a better place. We have the Bodhisattva ideal. So the Four Noble Truths is a very rational system, and it was modeled on a kind of a medical approach that was popular in the Buddha's day. What is the problem? What is its source? And how can it be fixed? You can't eliminate a problem if you don't know its source. So dukkha has three aspects. And the first one is ordinary dukkha. And this is known as dukkha dukkha, which includes illness, death, separation from people we love, and not getting what we desire. Okay? Ordinary dukkha. Second, dukkha produced by change. And that's called viparinama dukkha. As I've said, everything is impermanent, and we have a hard time with that. We fear getting old. And we're even a little unhappy when we get what we want because we're afraid it's not going to last. And then third is the dukkha of conditioned states. And that's samskara dukkha. The dukkha of conditioned states. What we call an individual is really made up of five aggregates. Form, feeling, perception, volition, and consciousness. Also known as the five skandhas. That's another teaching that I can't go into today. But it tells us that what we think of as the self is basically an illusion. If you look very deeply, if I look very deeply inside, there's really no Ted to be found. There are maybe 1,000 people in there that I slip in and out of being. Which one of them is the real Ted? There is no real Ted in there. And we suspect this sometimes, and it's a little troubling. When we practice Buddhism, this kind of suspicion, this no-self thing, it comes to the surface. And we learn to be comfortable there. And we like it there. It's a free place to be. So in Buddhism, we look deeply at suffering. And maybe you're not ready to do that, and that's fine. There are times in our lives when that is simply not the best thing to do. And that's okay. You must decide for yourself. You have to trust your deep instincts on this. If you do look deeply at suffering through a meditation practice, there are two things that you need. And I think one is courage. It takes some courage. It's not easy. You do this when you're strong. You build up your strength. And you know what makes you strong. You know what you have to do. And if you're not ready to approach these things yet, that's okay. That's okay. You spend some time gathering some strength. And the other is support. You really need support to do this. You need other people who are on the same path. And the ideal thing, I think, is to come here to Zen Center or a place like it. Find a sangha. Talk to each other, to other people. Take classes. Find a teacher. Those things are very important. You never need to be alone in this process. So I want to present something about this process in a meaningful way. I don't want to talk too much. I don't want to go any more into the catalog of types of suffering. If you've heard my talks, you know that I like to talk about personal experiences. So far, I've gotten away with that pretty well. Really, I like to do that because I think it brings things alive. Because all of this stuff, these kinds of ideas I've been talking about, it's not philosophy. It's something that we find in our lives. And we each find it directly in our lives and have a direct experience of these things that are deeper than words. It's not just a philosophy. So far, I've presented you with ideas, but this is not about ideas. It's about getting stuff deep in your bones in a way that's beyond ideas and even beyond words. So I would like to tell you a story about touching suffering. And this is a story of something that happened within my family. And it's a sad story. And I think it's also a deeply joyful story. And I'm going to start with talking about my wife, Kathy. Kathy and I got married about a little over 5 years ago here in the backyard. And she has a big family. She comes from a family originally of 12 kids. That's a big family. So it's been pretty cool for me to sort of acquire this family. And her mom is 91 years old now. And one of the strange things about her mom is that her name is Virginia. And that was my mom's name. I lost my mom quite a long time ago. And I'm sure it's just coincidence, but sometimes you kind of wonder, you know, is the universe trying to tell you something? It's not that common of a name. But I really love Kathy's mom. I'm really close to her. She's a very kind person, as moms tend to be. Very kind to her kids, of course. And very devoted to ideas of fairness in society. Very open, very tolerant, not judgmental. And very alive. Has this great spark of joy. The same one that my mom had. That just... you see them and their face lights up, you know, and it's just beautiful. And so I've known her for about 6.5 or 7 years, and she's had trouble walking that whole time. And about a year ago, something happened that made it very difficult for her to get around. She could still stand up, but couldn't really walk, and had started having really bad memory problems. And for a year, Kathy organized this heroic effort to take care of her so she could stay in her own home. And I think 5 of the siblings, all of them who are living in this area, would come in and stay with her, and they also hired some people. So she was getting 24-hour care. But 5 or 6 weeks ago, something happened, and she could no longer stand up. And her short-term memory started getting really bad. And... Kathy talked to all of her siblings, and they decided, you know, they just couldn't take care of her anymore, so it's time to move her to a nursing home. And this was really hard for Kathy, of course. No one ever likes to do this. And many of you have gone through this, I'm sure, or you will go through this someday. And you know what it's like. It is so hard. So that day came pretty quickly. Like, okay, it's today. We're moving. And Kathy and 4 of her siblings took her to the nursing home kind of mid-afternoon. And I arrived there after work. And they were just setting up her room. And Kathy's siblings left. It was just Kathy and me. And we were helping to do the paperwork. And there's a really, really sweet, wonderful person helping us with the paperwork. And we got that done, and we went down to dinner. Kathy and Virginia and I eating dinner in the nursing home there. And Virginia seemed to be doing okay. And we went into the room, and we just kind of chose a table, and there was a guy sitting there. And I think I introduced myself to him, and the first thing he did was shake my hand. His guy in a wheelchair, a little bent over, you know, looking like he's having a hard time. First thing he did was grip my hand really hard. I think he wanted me to know that he's still doing okay. And then he started talking to me. Well, the first thing he did was he reached in his wallet, and it took him a long time, and he got this little card out of his wallet, and he handed it to me, and I could see it was his neurosurgeon's card. And then he tells me, he's pointing to his head, 1, 2, 3, 4. And I said, you've had 4 surgeries. He says, yeah. And he's kind of smiling. He's kind of enjoying telling me this. And he talks to me about that, and he talks to me about some other things in his life, and he struggles for words a lot. You know, he can't remember things. And I get the feeling that it doesn't really matter what we're talking about, it just matters that we're talking. And I'm right there with him on this stuff, and he keeps smiling, and it's like he has this deep joy he wants to share with me. And he's struggling for the words, but he knows it's a joyful thing. And after dinner, he sang us a song. He sang this song in another language. And it was really nice. And I said, well, what language is that? And he said, Swedish. I said, oh, you're Swedish. He said, yeah. He was so happy to be Swedish. And he said, here's a guy who's suffering so much, you know, and yet he's got this joy. He's got this life in him, which I feel privileged to share a part of. And he just wants to connect. You know, that's all he wants. He just wants to connect. So then we went downstairs. Kathy and I wheeled Ginny down there. And we went outside. And there happened to be a guy playing some music down there. He was a banjo player. He had come, I think, to see somebody in the nursing home and had agreed to bring his banjo, and he just kind of set himself up with his music stand and his music book and his banjo outside, and there were a bunch of people gathered to to hear him. And there were maybe 20 people down there, kind of making this semicircle around him. Majority of them in wheelchairs, some walking, some guests, you know, like us, but mostly people living in the nursing home there. And some were obviously enjoying it. Some were like really unresponsive, and you just wondered, are they hearing it? Are they understanding it at all? He was good. It was enjoyable to watch him. And there was one guy who was a little younger than most of the people there. I think he was maybe about my age. And he seemed completely unresponsive, had his head down. And I looked at him and I wondered, is this guy present at all? Is he getting what's going on? At the end of one song, he raised his head up a little bit and he said, "Do you know any CCR?" Now, for you young people, that's Creedence Clearwater Revival. You can hear them on the Oldies channel. And then someone else who was also a bit younger asked for some Bob Dylan. And that made me realize, you know, the day is coming pretty soon when the predominant form of music in nursing homes is going to be rock and roll. Maybe heavy metal. Like, I can just picture some sweet guitar player coming in and doing this kind of old folks music, and we're going to be like, "Play Iron Man." And they're going to be like, "What?" And we're going to be like, you know, "Do, do, 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 do." And the food better be good, too, because our generation, we can stage a protest just like that. And it happened to be this incredibly beautiful evening. It was about 6 weeks ago, so it got dark, not as early as now, but kind of early. But at this time, it wasn't too warm, and there was this little breeze, and there was that beautiful evening light that we get sometimes. It's still sunlight, but it's so soft, and it just illuminates everything. It's like this sweet light that just illuminates everything beautifully. And I look around at the faces, you know, I look at Ginny's face, and she's smiling. Sometimes she's singing along, and she knows the song, and she's in this beautiful light. And it's a more beautiful light, I think, because you know it's not going to last so long. And then it seems to just last and last, and time seems to stand still in that kind of evening light. And this nursing home is across the street from a park, kind of an inner city park, and there was this big family there having a picnic, and it was a beautiful scene. And Ginny was smiling, and I steal a little glimpse at Kathy, and she's so near tears, and she's so alive. And I looked at all these people, and each of them with their own kind of suffering, and it had been such a big day. And I was emotional because, you know, Kathy and I were both very emotionally open because of what had happened on that day, and we saw all the beauty of those people. And I saw the spark of life in each of those people. And like, all my perception of their disabilities and problems just fell away. And I just saw the life in there, you know? And I saw the human connection. And that's all that matters. It's like I just saw their hearts and nothing wrong. And then I drove home. We had driven separately, so I drove home alone. And I was driving on Lake Street in East Minneapolis heading for St. Paul, and it was a Saturday night. And everybody was out. There were so many people. Every kind of person you could imagine, you know, every race and religion and ethnicity, every level of strength and weakness, some in triumph, some in defeat. And they all just looked so beautiful to me, the same as the people in the nursing home had. And it was just a joy to sort of rest my eyes on them, even the troublesome ones, you know, and the scary ones, especially them. It's so nice to be sort of liberated from judgment and just see the heart. And I've talked to Kathy about that night several times, and she says she had exactly the same experience. She said, "I thought I was compassionate before, but that night my heart really opened." And we couldn't talk about it for quite a long time without just getting really cheerful. And it made us happier. We wanted to go back there. We wanted that joyful experience of that heart-to-heart connection. And she was compassionate before. She cares for a lot of people, and not just a little bit here and there, but she'll take somebody on and look after their well-being for life. She's taken in kids and raised them. She looks after people in her family. She helps me look after people in my family. We were talking to someone at a Sangha event. Kathy's not a Buddhist, but she sometimes comes to these events. And I can't remember who it was, but Kathy was talking about what she does. And somebody said, oh, that's your ministry. And Kathy liked that because, you know, I have my ministry, which is my ministry, and she has hers, which is her family. And, of course, they overlap and we support each other. And what I'm able to do here, I'm able to do because of her. And I'm fully aware of what a lucky man I am to have such a person in my life, and to have this sangha, and to be able to do this Zen work, and to sit up here and be exactly the person I am. You know how many years it took me to find a place where I could be exactly who I am? So I have great gratitude. I have great gratitude to all of you, which I cannot express in words. But when I bow, it's there. So we keep going back to the nursing home, and Kathy goes more often than I do. I go at least once a week. Every week we've taken Ginny across the street for a picnic, which is really fun. And we see these same people. My friend who sang us the song, he's so happy to see us each time. We talk about different things. We were watching the news one night, and he asked me, who's president now? And I said, Obama. And he says, yeah, Obama. He's better than... And I said, George Bush. And he says, yeah. And then we went back to each of the presidents, and I got his opinion of each of them. It was nice. So there was this opening of the heart. And what does it have to do with dukkha? What does it have to do with dukkha? I think it has to do with all four of the four noble truths. It has to do with transcending pain. The four noble truths are about the elimination of suffering. And one way of looking at this is saying that we transform suffering into joy, or the suffering altogether. I think that's kind of the Theravadan view. The newer view, the Mahayana, suffering and joy are the same. We don't need samsara and replace it with nirvana. Samsara and nirvana are the same. There is a freedom in not making that distinction. And I think this experience that Kathy and I had, and which we've had other times, of course, too, and which we've all had, but we had it in a particularly intense way on that particular night, that... You know, seeing the pain and the loneliness of the people at the music, and seeing that spark of life, it was just a deep connection with other human beings, in which the joy was inseparable from the pain, and we were inseparable from those other people. And if I get a little teared up sometimes at the nursing home, you can't really name that emotion. It's not that simple. It's just the emotion. It's the emotion. So often at times of great stress, things are opened up to us. I was talking to someone years ago about how she had lost a parent and about how sad that was. And she says, you know, it was terribly sad, but it seemed to me that after it happened that I entered a sort of state of grace. And I knew what she was talking about because I lost both of my parents. And when that happens, at first, it is so stark. It is so incredibly stark. You do know what's important about life. Everything else is really stripped away. And in time, over years, at least it seems to me, that the joy of having known them is so mixed up with the pain of having lost them that it's just one thing. It's just this vivid, joyful, painful thing. It's just a direct experience of life. And I think that is something analogous to what the Buddha is talking about with the Four Noble Truths. Maybe not exactly the same. This sort of deep realization of the Four Noble Truths, I think, is something that happens in meditation, which is maybe not so tied up with emotion. But I think this sort of feeling, this opening of the heart, is an expression of that. So there's this human connection. And what else could possibly matter? What else is there? So I'm going to end with that. Thank you so much for listening this morning. And if anyone would like to make a comment or ask a question, I would certainly be open to that.
I'll start with one.
Okay.
Okay, you mentioned when you talked about right action, you're not being passive.
Right.
Oh, okay, but then you mentioned that joy and suffering are indistinguishable. And it seems there's a little inconsistency there, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, if you're not being passive, but you're taking right action to make something better in your life, make people around you happier, then suffering and nirvana are the same.
Mm-hmm.
So there seems to be a little inconsistency there. I'm sure it's not. And I'm sure you're gonna...
It seems like an inconsistency, but it's not. Things can get better. You know, we say nirvana, samsara are the same on a deep level. That's true. But still, we're living and operating in this world where there is pain, and we want to eliminate the pain. It's an irony. It's something that's inexplainable, I think. Both things are true at once. They may seem to be like opposite ideas, and yet we need to hold both of those ideas because both are true at once. I think that's the best I can do on that one. Any easy questions? Yes, Bruce.
Speaking about ambition, mm-hmm. and ambition is kind of connected to personhood, and it could be an illusion, but at the same time it creates kind of achievement.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that fit into this idea of trying to discard desire?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's ambition and there's ambition. I mean, there is a very healthy sort of goal setting because we're operating in the world. You know, we all have things we want to accomplish. Even within our practice, it makes sense to set goals. You know, I'm going to sit every day during practice period or something like that. But then there's kind of an attachment to the things we're ambitious about. Attachment is really seeing things for as if they have qualities they don't really have. If we have an idea of a goal, something we want to achieve, and we think it's going to fix all of our problems, and therefore we're going to totally focus ourselves on that goal, probably we're ascribing more power to that goal than it really has. You know, so we're deluding ourselves a little bit. We've gone a little bit beyond planning, and we've gone into attachment. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It seems sometimes that the time that I'm most aware of suffering is when I'm trying to determine what is mine to do.
What is, I'm sorry?
What is mine to do?
What is yours to do? Mm-hmm.
And that's not always an easy place. For instance, I have someone who I was married to for many years and is currently dying. He's now married again, and he's been married again for 20 years, so we have no ongoing relationship as such. But at the same time, what's been really important for me is, A, I don't believe that friendship and love just disappear. I think it's there, and mm-hmm. it may not be viable, but it's still there. But what I was trying to say is that So trying to work out for me what is mine to do in the situation where this man who is important in my life is dying. Is there something left to be said? That was the source of a lot of real hard looking at agendas. Like, do I have a hidden agenda? To me, that teasing out that stuff, that's where it gets hard for me, because I don't know the answer. It's the, you know, I have to wait for it to appear. And it seems to me that in your story, probably one part of your, at least as I would have put, as I would have experienced it, one of the biggest parts of suffering about your mother-in-law dying into the nursing home would have been making that decision in the first place.
Right, right, because that's our part of it. Yeah, I know what you're saying, and so, yeah, I anything you can do to help yourself see clearly here. You're wondering how much is of this is sort of your own self, your own interest talking, and you wonder what would it be like if that interest were not talking. So it's a matter of kind of knowing yourself, and I think just seeking great quiet and kind of being with this dilemma, but not in a thinking way, can be very helpful, that the answer, you know, may just come to you.
But it has, it has come to me. And in the end, I ended up with it, with what I regarded as a right action, because it came from love and compassion. Not from anything that I was told.
Good.
So, but that's what I'm saying, it takes time, it's not an immediate thing. Suffering can sometimes be a very subtle place.
Yeah. Well said, thank you. Yes?
Is that sort of the distinguishing factor of right action, that it has to come from love and compassion?
I think so. I think it doesn't come from desire. I think, you know, we take the self out of it in order to find right action.
And then the question is, if it comes from love and compassion, what is loving and compassion? Or if you're talking about something that's related to another person, what is the right action?
Well, that is not always easy to know. Sometimes what appears first to be the compassionate thing may turn out not to help at all. So there's a great deal of wisdom involved too, and also understanding our own motivation. And I think being open is very important, just continually asking, what is it now? What is the right thing to do now? Anytime we kind of get fixed ideas about things or follow a pattern, we may not be seeing clearly. You know, to just continually wake up and see this person anew. It's kind of like raising a child. They change so fast, you know. Every few days you have to take a fresh look at them. Who is this person? And what does this person need now? But we're really all like that. The openness and
what is the direction that Buddhism provides about right action?
I can't think of anything specific, really, beyond what I've just said. It involves clear seeing of the situation and knowing the right thing to do arises out of that. And you know what? There really are many rules. I wish we had simple rules. I mean, we do have precepts, we have ethical guidelines and all of those things, which are very, very important. But they're all based on clear seeing at the moment. You know, they're never reduced to laws. Unfortunately, life can never be that easy.
Ted, don't you think that if you act with loving kindness and perform right action, and that your takeaway from that is not that I'm a good person doing this, okay, but rather this needed to be done, it's done, and now it's on to other things, whatever that may be, without looking back and saying, well, geez, you know, I'm such a great person because I helped this person or whatever. And for me, at least, that's the way I try and differentiate about whether I'm being attached to something and I've got some desire going versus I'm actually really trying to just live in the moment and do what is right.
Right, right. And that is the bodhisattva ideal. You're not doing it to show that you're a great person or for your own happiness, you know. And we all, you know, kind of aspire to be that way. But I think it's good to be kind of forgiving of ourselves, too, because that stuff tends to get wrapped up a little bit, you know. You may have this moment of, gee, I'm really something, you know. Okay, you see it, you let it go, you forgive yourself for having this persistent ego, you know. But you're absolutely right that if that's the driving force, your own desire, I think you're more likely to do harm rather than help, because you're doing stuff based on your needs, not on their needs. And those may be very inconsistent. Thank you. Yes?
Oh, I just made me think of, you know, how people sometimes perform what they perceive to be right actions, and they keep getting, they don't get the results that they want, you know, and they're confounded by why things aren't going their way. And I think a lot of it has to do with that they're attached to the outcomes, and there's no reason for doing it. Selfish, not selfless. And maybe not let that,
you know,
confounded of life and doing all these great things, and he's appreciating it.
Right. Yeah, I always think do the work with no expectation of reward. You know, that's not what it's about. Yes.
I don't know if this is just a Buddhism thing you want to say, and of course you're coming from the Andrew Court, and I was kind of hesitant a little bit because I'm the only Japanese in here, and then I should say this or that. We were watching a movie a couple of nights ago about the emperor, and I heard a story about it. I don't think any of you watched it. But at the end of the war, you know, MacArthur came, and he was trying to see if the emperor was a war criminal. And at the end, he met with the emperor, and the emperor actually stood in front of him and said, "It's my fault, you know, don't execute those." That kind of actually made him, MacArthur, decide that he's not a criminal. Uh-huh. Now there's other, you know, plots behind it also. But I mean, you know, there's a thinking that if you try to get something, and if you want it, you're not going to get it. Mm-hmm. In order to get it, you have to let it go.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, by emperor actually saved himself and the rest of Japan by giving himself up.
Yeah.
You know, if he wanted it, you know,
he would have judged
as a war criminal.
Yeah. Giving yourself up. But that's kind of this practice of continually giving yourself up, you know, throwing yourself out there.
Yeah, it's every moment. That, you know, if you have ambition, you know, you can't really let it go, you know.
If you what?
If you have the ambition, but if you want something, that alone is not going to really, you know, you kind of get on your way. That's kind of hard to, you know, let it completely go.
Yeah.
But you don't know if you're going to get it or not.
Thank you. Okay, maybe one more. Jeff, yes.
In 1881, Johann Berger emigrated from Sweden and arrived in Minneapolis with his family, which included four children and my grandfather, Charles. And he got a job with the Minneapolis Streetcar Railway Company as a laborer working on tracks. Back then, streetcars were mostly horse-drawn, but they were also experimenting with steam-powered streetcars. And he was apparently laying track or working on the line that ran between Minneapolis and Excelsior through Minnetonka. The family was living on the east side of the city by the river. And on July 14th, which was a Saturday, the end of the workday came, and he was somewhere west of Minnetonka. And he was on the rail line, which ran, I guess it was part of the Minneapolis St. Louis Railroad. And there was a freight that was coming in from the west and headed into the city. There was also a passenger train, which was departed from Minnetonka and headed west in the opposite direction. So Johann decided he would hop the freight in order to get home faster. to his family. He did. But he missed his footing. And he was thrown into the path of the oncoming passenger locomotive. And he was killed. My grandfather at that time was 10 years old. Imagine what his life had been like up till that point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, leaving his home in Sweden 2 years previous to this, moving to this very strange and new country, and then losing his father. I, of course, don't know how his life would have worked out had his father not missed his footing
mm-hmm.
on that train. My grandfather went on to meet and marry my grandmother on my father's side. And, of course, they had children, including my father, and children, including me. But if Johann had not missed his footing on that freight train, I don't think I would be here telling you this story.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all a product of this impermanence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't pick out one thing and say, that doesn't fit. Okay. Thank you.
Jeff, you're right, but you'd still be here.